You are listening to Screenfish Radio. I'm your host, Steve Norton. This week on the show, I'm talking solo, and I'm not alone as we bring back podcaster David Peck, as well as director Nathaniel Draper, to talk about one of the more controversial films in the Star Wars universe. Although, to be fair, they all feel controversial at this point, don't they? In this episode, we have a great conversation about the future of the Star Wars universe, the nature of freedom, and what it means to be the good guy. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Welcome to Screenfish Radio. We are so excited this week to talk about Solo, a Star Wars story. And for this episode, we are thrilled to have back David Peck. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Glad you could be back on. And Screenfish newbie or guppy or whatever term you want to use, Nate Draper. Welcome, Nate.
Newbie works, I suppose.
Great. This week, as we talk about Solo, a Star Wars story, we talk about a film that has been quite divisive amongst its fans and critics. It follows the chronicles of a young Han Solo, played by Alden Ehrenreich.
And yeah, I don't know.
I'm still not sure. I love him as an actor, and I'm still not sure how to pronounce his last name. Who shows us the hero of the original trilogy in his youth, where he first meets people like Chewbacca, Lando Calrissian, and of course the Millennium Falcon, and takes him on his own, no pun intended, solo adventures. It's been a wildly divisive film, guys, in a lot of ways. Some critics have loved it. Some have thought it was unnecessary. You've got fans that stayed away. They're saying that this is the first Star Wars film that's going to lose money, which is crazy to think of when they're making billions and billions. I was wondering, why do you guys think that a film like this has caused so many concerns and divisions? Issues.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I don't know how you feel about this kind of stuff, Nate, being a filmmaker and all, and you've got a real love, obviously a love for film and foreign film and so on. But I think with certain stories, certainly, and with the Star Wars, franchise, it's really personal, right? And as a fan, one of the thoughts I was thinking about when you were sort of introducing me there, Steve, was who would have thought that, I'm 52, for heaven's sakes, what am I doing still going to see Star Wars movies? why is that even happening? Why am I so interested to find out about did Han Solo really do the Kessel Run in 12 parsecs? Does it really matter? And apparently you have to round down in order to get 12 parsecs, right? So anyway, I love that line, by the way. That was my fave line in the whole film was, I've got a really good feeling about this. It's my fave line. It's got to be one of my faves. But I think it becomes really personal, and people are so opinionated about it. And so I think, too, when we heard that the director was changing, and I don't know about you guys, but I love Ron Howard and what he's done, as a director and a filmmaker. But everybody goes, oh, great, the film must have been having trouble, and they sort of were. And then you start to read some of that, and you wonder, okay, the story's going to go sideways. And I just for the record, I actually really loved it. Mm-hmm. I think that it's been kind of underrated by a lot of critics. And so those are a couple thoughts that I had. It's Star Wars, man. It's moving the story forward. And even if I hated it, I think I still would have had a smile on for the whole film. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, so I was a little surprised to hear that it's a bit more polarized, the response. I also loved it too. I thought it was a really fun movie. I'm curious because I saw that among critics it was getting, there was good and bad reviews for it. I was actually quite surprised that more critics didn't respond to it positively, because I think it's a really on multiple fronts, it's well done. And I wonder how much of the fan response to it is just coming from a place of people have their own idea of what the Star Wars, the Han Solo story was supposed to be. And I wonder how much of that is people just reacting to someone else other than Harrison Ford playing Han Solo. and just certain ideas of the world that maybe they took liberties with that fans were that fans had some pushback against, maybe.
You know what, to Steve and Nate, I wonder, is, you know, as you were just talking about that, Nate, I wonder, is there any actor that really could have stepped into, you know, Han Solo's role? I mean, it's like playing a young Rick Deckard, right? I mean, yeah. How do you do that? How do you live up to those kinds of expectations? And with all the spin-offs and the books and the comics and just, and how the legend has grown, right? And how the story, and that's, I think, one of the brilliant things about great storytelling. I mean, it grows for each and every one of us, and we all bring our own understanding and our context and relationships at the time and the memories, right? I mean, it's, don't screw with that, you know, Hollywood. And maybe some people are feeling like it, but I'm with Nate. I don't quite get it either, because I think it's a better movie than some of the critics have been saying.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I watched it, I honestly went with low expectations. I kind of, but having, you know, it had been out a week or two until I saw it, and you know, my expectations were low. But I actually thought that this would be the first Star Wars film that I didn't like, and I really enjoyed it. Like, it was well made. It fit the Star Wars universe fairly well. It seemed like it wasn't out of place. The cast was excellent. Donald Glover steals the movie in so many ways, for me anyway. But, you know, it's interesting. One of the things I've been wrestling with, because people are saying it's been too much too soon, but we get a Marvel movie every, you know, 6 hours, or so it feels. Mm-hmm. I think the change in focus is the big problem. Because what Disney is doing, and I don't think they're doing anything wrong, but they're taking a story that's been focused on one family, and they're trying to take a generational story and broaden it into a universe. And I'm not even saying they're doing a bad job, but I think that might be part of the struggle. When Marvel started their whole cinematic universe, they almost started fresh because nobody had done a good job on Captain America before. There had been no Iron Man before. They sort of started with these people that nobody knew. But these are characters that we've all followed for 40 years. And I don't know who else could have played Harrison Ford. I heard rumors that the original cut of the film was so wild, and it was a lot of improv and almost a wacky comedy, which is what sank the ship so early. You know, when Ron Howard came in, I thought he steered it into a solid direction. It's safe, quote unquote safe, compared to where they were going. But it was a really good adventure. I thought Alden Ehrenreich actually did a really solid job myself. Apparently that had to do with the re-edits, though, because the other guys weren't as interested in having him act like Harrison Ford, is what I'm hearing. I don't know if that's accurate or not. What do you guys think of the actual film, though? I mean, you guys said you liked it. What was it that you liked about it?
But yeah, for me, it's just being back in the universe. I mean, I think and again, just to sort of circle back on the first question and why some people might not like it. You're playing with icons. You're playing with legends. You know, everybody wondered about J.J. Abrams, you know, stepping back into it. Is he going to pull it off? And part of the reason I think he pulled it off is because he pretty much made, you know, A New Hope. Right. Yeah. I mean, he pretty much made the same movie, and it did it so well. And it did ridiculously well at the box office and so on, but also just really, it was really satisfying. And I think maybe, I mean, I felt like from a, just the layout of the film, the cinematography and so on, and the way it just from it, the get-go, it had a bit of a Blade Runner-like feel, you know, the sets, the lighting, and it's a little bit, even though it's fun, it does have a bit of a darker edge to it. So I wonder to what degree that's also kind of playing into this. It's not quite what I had in mind, Ron. You know, this isn't what I was hoping you were going to do with it. But yeah, for me, to answer your question, Steve, it's just the universe. It's the story. I was Luke Skywalker for 3 years of my life, you know, and so I wanted to live on a planet that had two suns. I mean, like, count me in, you know? So, and seeing all the bits of business, you know, Tobias handing Han his blaster that becomes the blaster that shoots Greedo. I mean, that's just like, I love that stuff, you know, how he gets his name, that he basically, Han Solo fueled the rebellion. I mean, this is just too unbelievable. I had no idea, you know. I hope you guys can hear the smile as I say that, but it's just, love that. What about you, Nate?
One of the things that I thought it did really well, well, first of all, it's just a really fun movie.
Yeah.
I can't remember the last time in the last 6 months I just enjoyed watching something. One of the things that I liked about it is I think it covered all the bases that a Han Solo story needed to cover. So how he got the Millennium Falcon, how he met Lando Calrissian, how he and Chewbacca met. That was actually one part of the movie that I thought was, what was interesting was, it starts off with it's a love story, and it's him trying to get back to this other person, and then it becomes the story of the friendship between him and Chewbacca, and it was really neat how, like, they also subtly explain, like, how does he understand Chewbacca? And then there's that scene where they're fighting in that underground cavern where he meets Chewbacca, where he starts making these weird noises, and then, oh, he actually understands Wookiee somehow. I guess they don't entirely explain how he knows it, but the building the relationship between the two of them so that by the end, it basically, like, they have formed a strong bond between the two of them. So that was one reason why I liked it, because I think it explained all those things. And I also think what it did, too, is it showed, because when you see him in A New Hope, he's very reluctant about having any sort of relationships or friendships with anybody. And I think it also explains that, too, with Woody Harrelson's character, that you can't trust anyone, and how that outlook influences him.
So Nate, do you feel like, you know, in A New Hope and so on, I mean, Leia's impression of Solo is he's a scoundrel, he's a cad, et cetera. He's a crook. He's a con man. Do you get enough in this film that suggests that that's the guy he's going to become? I mean, they do certainly lead us to believe. I mean, we now know he shot first, right? We now know he shot first. It wasn't Greedo.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so on that, what I think is interesting. You could look at it different ways. I think it's more of when he gets to A New Hope, like he plays. It's interesting because it almost is now in the context of the greater Star Wars universe. I'm curious how it would play if you were to watch Solo and then watch A New Hope. If the Han Solo in A New Hope would come off as more like he's putting up a front. Because in Solo, it's suggested that, no, you're actually a good person. And he says, no, I'm not. And yeah. So I guess the question would be, how much of that is him just putting up a front because he actually cares and doesn't want to get involved because it hurts too much?
Well, that was
simple. Well, it's also interesting too when Tobias says something like I'm doesn't he say something to the effect of Solo that I'm like you, and Tobias says, yeah, no, you're nothing like me.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the things that I thought was interesting, guys, is, of course, in the original, you've got Leia calling him, you're a scoundrel. He says, you love me because I'm a scoundrel. But Kira here says, I know who you are, you're the good guy. So is he? My question is, why do we love this guy? Why is he considered the good guy? Because he does bad things, quote-unquote, like, to oversimplify it. Like, he does do things that are, quote-unquote, bad things.
Well, and I wonder, though, how intentionally bad the decisions that Solo solo banks really are. Do you know what I mean? Like he dumps and runs. We learned that pretty quickly too, right?
Yeah, that's true.
He drops the payload and takes off. He makes these rash decisions. He flies into the asteroid field, you know. He and yet still seems to pull it off. So he's a risk taker. He's a gambler. And then for the most part, he seems to come out on top and does incredibly well. But I think he ultimately is a good guy. I think he ultimately does make very good decisions. And if you look back and you start to explain, you know, his life, it makes sense that he comes back to bail Luke out in A New Hope when they take down the Death Star, you know, the thing that we all wanted to happen. And that surprises us all, I think, when he comes back in with, you know, at the end of the film.
Well, I think it's also interesting, too, when he drops the payload, it's also to rescue Woody Harrelson's character and Chewbacca.
Yeah, great point. Yeah.
It, a lot of it actually seems really at the root of it's very selfless. In fact, he even goes back to rescue Lando at one point. Lando's, you know, gone to rescue his droid, L3, and Han goes to then, like, he sees Lando's in trouble, and then he goes and rescues him.
Yeah. He's not happy about it, but he goes back.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's sort of the reluctant hero part, I suppose, that all people would associate with Han Solo. But I think really at his core, he's a very selfless person.
One of the things I noticed, of course, they don't do the scrolling text. I had a friend, and they were very concerned there was no scrolling text. I said, they're not doing those in the side stories. But in the opening dialogue, it talks about a young man fights for survival but yearns to fly among the stars. And, man, doesn't that sound like Luke? Like, in a lot of ways, I thought that the young Solo reflected, albeit different from different circumstances, reflected a young Luke Skywalker.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because, they come from different... I was going to say Luke comes from a stable home. I think stable might be overemphasizing it, but, I mean, he's raised by Owen and Beru. And Han is coming from a world that doesn't care about him. He says his name, and they say nobody cares. He gets to the... You know, he gets to the border. Who's your tribe? I don't have. Or who's your family? What's your name? I don't have one. He's completely cut off, and he's coming from a world that nobody wants to be at. Nobody wants to be in it, and nobody wants to go back to it. So I just wondered if maybe you've got this guy who seems to yearn for something. He yearns for something else, but I don't know if he knows what it is. You know, at the end, I think it's Enfys Nest. That's what I'm thinking of. The leader of
the rebellion.
The rebellion. Yeah. Enfys Nest.
Yeah.
So when he meets Enfys Nest, Enfys actually sort of invites him to join in the rebellion, and he does no interest of it then either. Sort of walks away. I got to get my ship, you know?
Well, but what's interesting there and fascinating to me is he has no interest in it, but he has brought them the fuel, the actual fuel, never mind about the metaphor of this, but he's brought them the fuel that starts, you know, largely is a huge part of the rebellion. Hmm. They, in a way, you know, she calls it the blood that brings life to something new.
Yeah.
I mean, how crazy is that? And yet he says, no, I can't help.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. Love that. Love that kind of stuff. So ultimately, maybe you're right about the Luke. Maybe he's more Luke than we know.
Yeah. They had this sort of same life to it. And they're both wanting to get off their rock and look for something. You know, they seem to be almost on the same quest, but with different locations. I don't know. That's just sort of how I felt about the character.
I have to say, you know, sorry to sort of go to a little to take this in a bit of a different direction, and maybe
no,
it's connected
it.
In some interesting way, weird way. But I got to say, I loved watching him win the Falcon in the game. That just brought home the I won it fair and square, baby. You know, just brought it all back home. And Lando, the true conman that he is, has a holdout up his sleeve. It's so great. It's hysterical. Fantastic.
Well,
love that stuff.
Well, I'll go back to another thing. Part of the other reason I think the movie worked, too, is I think they were obviously very aware in writing it, the things that the audience was going to be thinking about and anticipating. So that's
yes.
The thing. If you're familiar with Star Wars, you're going to know that he won the Millennium Falcon from Lando. And so that was very smart of them to have that first scene where he actually loses.
Yeah.
Because then you're going, oh, wait, but he's actually got to win. So how that means there's got to be at another point this has got to actually happen. And they throughout the movie, there were little bits like that where they played with.
Well, you know what, Nate? There's lots of little bits like that, and I haven't done any. I'd love to go. I bet you there's a couple of sites online that are saying, "Hey, here are all the places where they, you know, they do a shout out to the Star Wars universe." But I mean, for instance, the mask, the helmet that Tobias is wearing when they go back to the Kessel mines. By the way, seeing the spice mines of Kessel was just too cool for me as well. But anyway. He's wearing the same mask that Lando wore in Return of the Jedi when they came to rescue Han, right?
Yeah, that's the same one.
Yeah.
So I just, again, those kinds of little bits of business, I love the way, you know, writers and directors, and Lawrence Kasdan wrote this with his son, I believe, didn't he?
Yeah, with Jake. With Jake.
So I wonder, I've seen it twice now, and I didn't really catch the fact that Tobias handed hands, you know, Han is blaster, and that is the blaster that, you know, the iconic blaster.
Yeah, I caught the mask. I thought the mask was an interesting throw in. There were tons of those little things as well, you know.
That's another way too. Like, well, it's interesting because the Millennium Falcon in the original seems to have a bit of a personality of its own. And then the whole thing with L3, they having to install L3's hard drive into the Millennium Falcon.
Yes.
I think it's mentioned a lot. And also when C-3PO later comes in and says, I can actually speak to the computer in one of the later original episodes, then that also gives the ship itself like a personality with which he can communicate. I'm not sure how much of that was intentional, but...
Right.
That's interesting.
C-3PO talks to the Millennium Falcon at one point down the road.
Yeah, I need you to talk to the Falcon. Yeah, you're right. Nice. I hadn't even considered that.
Nice.
I wondered how that
did anybody else? Did anyone else find the relationship between Lando and L3 just a tiny bit creepy?
Well, they said the week after its release, they announced that Lando was pansexual. So that was they said, yes, he is indeed in love with a robot. That's
well,
what.
There you go.
There it is. It clarifies it much very easily.
We got it covered then.
There you go. Well, it's interesting. With this Star Wars movie, it kind of ventures more into science fiction in terms of that whole question of like sentience with droids—that's never actually something that's in any of the Star Wars movies that's being questioned. It's always taken as a given where they have feelings and thoughts, or they don't ever talk about it until this one actually, which I thought was interesting too.
It's a little more Nate. It's a little more Hal, right? From 2001.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they sort of give L3 a soul in many ways. It's where they sort of move her into the Falcon. Now she's one with the ship now, Lando says. I think that's quite a different look than other incarnations. You know,
the other little shout out too, and I'm going to start thinking them, of course, after our conversation is over. But the chess game, right? That's a lovely little shout out. And then Chewie gets so angry at the game, right? That's also a nice little callback.
And there's also I Hate You, I Know, which I thought was a neat little flip around there. I love that. You know, it's funny going. You know, you talk about all these little callbacks. In some ways, I think that this is part of maybe the problem on a larger scale. Like, I think for Star Wars to grow and expand, it can't rely so much on the backstories of people we already know. It's got to create people that we don't. And the more that you focus on the Solo and the Lando, it's cool if you really like watching if you love watching the old movies like I do, like we do. But if you want to build on that, it may be more difficult than they think. I think they almost have to start, like, I know they're starting two new trilogies, one with Rian Johnson and one with the guys from Game of Thrones. But it you know, like, I look at the fan culture concerns me because what was the issue recently? Rose from The Last Jedi just got off Instagram because of people that have been trashing her for the last 4 months since the film's release because it didn't live up to their expectations.
Oh, you've got to be kidding. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. That well, just happened I mean,
they
this
knocked,
week.
They knocked it out of the park on Rogue One, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Well, I think the films have been great. I really I enjoyed Rogue One, and I've enjoyed this one. I'm not even just saying that as a Star Wars fan. I just, like Nate said, I just enjoyed the film. It's a lot of fun. But the fanboy culture they're running into, I almost think they need to start with some new people so that it kind of releases itself from the burden of the stories of the past. I don't know. I might be overthinking it, but...
So what's with all the marks all over, what's his name, Dryden's face, Paul Bettany's face? What's with the markings? Is he got some sort of Jedi-like Darth Maul thing going on there? Anybody else notice that?
I didn't even notice that. Nate, did you notice any of that?
I saw the marks. I wasn't sure. I mean, it's possible because he had a weapon that wasn't the blaster, so it's possible that it's meant to imply that he's had some sort of training that's related to, you know, what would have been some kind of Jedi fighting.
Some sort of like either tattoo or are these battle scars like from this weapon that he's using?
Did I also see, like, when he gets mad, does it actually get? I don't know if I saw it, if I'm just imagining this, but I think when he gets mad, those veins sort of pulse a little bit more.
Oh, okay. Didn't
pick up any of that.
Look more menacing.
And what's with the Game of Thrones lightsaber? Why we go to a sword?
Oh yeah, that was.
This is like, what is this, like pre lightsaber? We're using an actual blade. How unsophisticated is that?
What did you think of the cameo, guys? What Nate? What did you think of the cameo that has rocked the world?
Are you talking about the
Maul,
the White Walker alter ego cameo?
No, Maul, man.
Yeah,
what are you talking about?
I was making a really obscure reference to Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
I was he looks like the Darth Maul character looks like one of the White Walkers in Game of Thrones.
Oh yeah.
And I just thought it was funny that it's then someone from Game of Thrones who's then talking to Darth Maul at the end of the movie. I actually thought it was kind of cool.
Is it actually supposed to be Darth Maul?
It's him.
It is actually Darth Maul. Because they do bring Darth Maul back in the animated series. The Rebels.
Okay.
I think.
Yes, he did. He survives.
Yeah.
So did the lightsaber cauterize the two body halves? Is that what they're trying to tell me?
I think it's he gets into some weird dark Jedi practice or something like that. That's why now he's Maul. He's not he's sort of this his own dark Jedi on his own within the film. So it's he does quote unquote grow his legs back, I think, based on what you hear from the animated series.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, or I think they're like robotic legs.
Oh, that could be it too. That would make more sense, actually. Something like that.
I actually thought Darth Maul was a cool character. In fact, I actually wanted it was just, with the prequels. I actually thought he could have been a cool antagonist for all of the prequels if they hadn't killed him in the first one. But.
Well, I think that's a general consensus, but most people don't know, like, if they haven't watched the cartoon, for example, like, either one, Clone Wars or, what was the other one, Rebels.
Rebels, yeah.
People are just confused. They're like, well, he's dead. But they set this up for a trilogy, and they're saying there won't be any more because it's going to lose any money, but there are rumors that Ray Park is in talks to do the Obi-Wan movie. Which I think would be outstanding. I think you're right. I feel like Darth Maul was one of those guys that just didn't get his due. They created this incredible character, and then he sawed him in half.
He had like one line, and then they chop him in half.
Because he had a terrible voice.
Nate, question for you. As a filmmaker, what did you think of what they did with the music? I know how careful you are about music and editing and so on. I love the way they brought in the actual, you know, John Williams like original score at a couple of really, you know, important moments when he sits down into the cockpit, right? There's a couple like that that are just, yeah, you know, for me creates a couple of shivers up the spine, goosebumps.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, I think that because those themes are so iconic, and already we have associations with those melodies in terms of where they fit in other movies. So it just makes more sense, like, as an audience, that moment would have more emotional resonance because you're then, just musically, you're relating it to another moment that's
Yes.
Yeah, it was interesting because I think the music on this one was actually written by, composed by John Powell, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, that was interesting. Yeah, well, that wasn't John Williams. And then they had some, they took the music in a different direction at some point. But I mean, I thought it was a really interesting way in which that they, like, they changed the style a little bit because there was a bit more of like a choir, it felt like. For some of it, which I hadn't heard in other movies, but I felt like it fit, and I felt like it was, it all worked.
Yeah, I like the cinematography. That I thought they it was an interesting new look by going with Bradford Young, because you know, here's the director of Arrival making a Star Wars film, and sort of the tint and the darkness to it. But still, the script sort of maintained the light tone, but there was sort of a heaviness to the actual cinematography, which I thought was really well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it had almost kind of more of like a natural, almost gritty look for some of the scenes, especially at the beginning when they're on what's the planet called? Corellia. Yeah, yeah. It seems in terms of the way they use the lighting, it was a lot more. Like natural light sources, as a, like, and it looked very. It had a more like soft, diffused look to it.
Well, and
to where you're getting like these one directional light sources, which is more dramatic, right. Too.
Well, and I just felt really dark as well, and I kind of, I mean, throughout seeing it the second time, I sort of wondered where was Ron Howard in this? Like, what were his scenes versus the earlier scenes, and how much was, you know, taken out and had to, how much of it had to be reshot and so on. I don't know if they're going to have that kind of an extra on the DVD or not, but it would certainly be worth hearing the director's commentary on this one. That's for sure. How can you not love the fact, and I think I heard this properly, but Han Solo's father actually built this Millennium Falcons, those ships.
Yeah,
like that. I love that kind of stuff. You know, there's just you start to get the history of it. I mean, I have not followed the cartoons. I have not really. I mean, I collected the comic book as a kid. I didn't really get into any of the narrative, the fictional stuff that was done in literature, and there was so much of that. So I'm sure there's a lot of different, you know, takes and approaches on the history and so on, and the origin stories and so on. But yeah, I love that. Kind of thing.
Yeah.
Came up in so many different ways in this film, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the funny thing is when Disney... Oh, go ahead.
Explains a bit more how he actually knows how to fly it, too.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, good. Yeah. Well, and how brilliant is it that the Empire, in a way, taught him how to become a great pilot? I mean, he was clearly a pilot before, but I don't know. Love those little bits.
Yeah. Yeah. You know... Thinking about this, guys, one of the things I think is a key theme in this movie is the idea of freedom. I was wondering, what do you think freedom looks like in a movie like Solo? How is it expressed?
Well, you know what? Immediately, the first thing that comes to mind is L3, and doesn't she make a crack about equal rights at some point?
Yeah, she makes several. Congratulations, you're liberated.
So is that just sense of humor? Is that the C-3PO-like sense of humor coming out? Or is that actual oppression that we're talking about? You know, there's that scene in the cage where the cage fighting, the ultimate fighting between droids is going on.
Yeah.
Right? And she's talking to the other droid, you gotta get out of this lifestyle, etc. So it makes you wonder. So yeah, no, I don't know. I need to reflect on that a little bit more, but and doesn't Kira say something to Solo about it's not about winning, it's about how long you stay in the game? Or
yeah, it's not that kind of game, Han. The object isn't to win it, the object is to stay in it as long as you can.
That's right. Yeah.
What do you think, Nate?
Well, it's just like certainly like freedom. The idea of freedom does come up, especially with L3. It's funny because they turned it into a really funny moment where she she takes the, I guess, the controlled, it's a little control device off of one of the droids, and then tells it offhandedly, like, I don't know, go liberate your brothers. And then it goes and starts this whole revolution. And what's interesting with Solo's character, like, it, from the beginning, it's him, yeah, wanting to have freedom. But what's interesting is, like, his idea of freedom is he wanted to be with one person in particular, and then by the end of the movie, that person has betrayed him. So I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah,
looks like in it. Yeah.
And Nate, she, I think she's betrayed him because she's no longer free, right? She's now enslaved in some other way, and we're not really quite sure why. But she sort of alludes to some things that happened in those 3 years. Oh, you would never forgive me if you knew, et cetera, right? So she's enslaved. She's a slave in a sense. She in a way, she no longer has the choice, it seems. Mm-hmm. And yet makes this critical choice in the film to this, you know, the battle scene at the end, the sword fight.
Mm-hmm. And what's also interesting, too, is, like, Han is this character who doesn't follow rules. But throughout the movie, you have references to, like, oh, everybody works for somebody else. I think Kira even says that.
Right, you're right. That's right.
Just that everybody works for somebody else.
Yeah.
And Han is the guy going, but I don't want to follow any rules. And I think that's why he doesn't join the rebellion. I think it's because he's Solo. He doesn't want to he wants to not have to fit into a structured system. He's kind of an anarchist, I suppose.
But that was one of the things that caught my attention in this one, too, is that you're right. He is sort of on his own, and he doesn't want to be tied down. But here's a guy who I think freedom for him is actually really tied closely to relationship. I mean, so much of the film is about him trying to find Kira, but he finds Chewbacca, and you know, he moves from romance to bromance, if you will. Like and one of the things that they say when he's translating for Chewbacca, I think he says, I don't know if he said tribe or family, and I think it's Beckett that says to him, "What's the difference?" I could be wrong on Beckett, but it's like,
oh yeah, yeah.
So there's this bond that he is looking for without the rules. You know, it's an interesting balance for him because, yeah, he wants to do his thing on his own and he wants to be free, but freedom isn't by himself. It's interesting.
Well, and what's the name of the character? Yeah, what's the name of the character? I forget the details around. Is it Rio?
Rio Durant.
He actually says it.
Yeah.
Yeah. He actually said it's not good. They're sitting around the fire. Not good to be alone, kid. Thandi Newton's character. Why did you bring these crazy guys on board with us here? What are you doing? And then that whole conversation about relations got to be about a girl. And yeah, you don't want to die alone, kid.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you've got somebody who is known for being a loner, but doesn't want to be alone. He could ditch Chewbacca at any time, but he doesn't.
Well, and you know what's so beautiful too? This is really fun. So he and there's that scene where Chewie wants to go help his people, his tribe, right? When they're at the ones that are enslaved on Kessel in the spice mines,
right?
And Solo's standing there, and it's kind of like, oh, you got to come with me, Chewie. What are you doing? Oh, you know what? I got to let this guy go. Throws him the weapon and says, basically, hopefully we meet again. And then they split and they separate. I mean, Matt, isn't that true freedom?
Yeah.
Having the ability and true love, the ability to, you know, kind of to let go, right? And to move on. And anyway, it's I haven't really reflected on that until right now.
When you guys were talking earlier, you're talking about relationship and setting him up for the way he relates to people in the later films. I think that's really interesting to look at because you're right. Like guys like Beckett, Kira, pretty much everybody in the film almost plays out like an Ocean's 11 movie where everybody's betraying everybody.
yeah. There is a lot of like there's a lot of backstabbing, especially towards the end of the movie. It's kind of a free for all.
Yeah, yeah. It was it, Did you find, I don't know, did you find it got weirdly political when he got in the army, in the military? Because there were a couple of points where it's interesting. He says, you know, it's their planet. We're the hostiles. And it just felt to me like it was, that was, you know, like the old films were sort of commentary on this time. That sort of felt like a commentary on today.
Definitely. Yeah. I definitely, it was a pretty clear comparison that they were making. I mean, I thought it was very fitting. I thought it definitely worked. But it's certainly, in terms of how it's actually put on screen, it's very obvious that they're making making a jab at, you know, the sort of the American identity and the international foreign intervention. And then, it's comparing that to the Empire.
Yeah. It's amazing to me how after 40 years, we can still look at the Empire and it still translates, you know?
Yeah.
And it just translates differently in different functions. And actually, in this one, though, the Empire isn't in it that much. Like, he joins the Empire, but, you know, we don't see a huge Imperial presence, but they're sort of in the background. It's really interesting to me.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because I don't think there's a stormtrooper in the entire film.
Oh, no, there are. There are at the beginning when they're trying to escape.
Oh, yeah, of course.
When they're at that spaceport, the train space station.
Right.
There's stormtroopers there.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, I forgot about that, yeah. But again, like, you know, Rogue One, it was very steeped in that battle of rebellion versus Empire. And this one seems like it's in another piece of the galaxy. I like that aspect of it. I do like the world, you know, as David was saying.
Yeah.
I do like the world. And this film sort of reminded me of that, is that I don't need all the lightsabers to appreciate what they're trying to create. I hope other people can get on board on that stuff. I laughed, though. I had to admit, I kind of laughed when Darth Maul whips out the red lightsaber, because it was almost like his, you know, calling card. It's like, no, I swear, it's really me.
Yeah, in case you are wondering, just so that there's no doubt, this is, you've seen this before.
Because if you think about it, he's on the phone.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
I'm watching it, and he's having this conversation with Kira, and it's like, why? She knows who you are. It's okay.
Yeah. Do you end all your phone calls with turning on the lightsaber just so we know you have it? Or maybe it's like, I don't get to use it very often. I should just turn it on so I can at least hear it.
Yeah, that's right. I didn't check the batteries earlier. I should just make sure.
Yeah. But yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because when you think of, like, what's interesting about this one is it's not the Rebels versus the Empire. The Empire, it's much more character focused in terms of, it's a kind of a small scale story in that it's really just Han and this group of people. But that's also something that I liked about it too, because it actually focuses it a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because I find that doing that, I actually find those films more powerful, just because they're closer to like a human experience, and I think that it works for this film, especially after making a film to explain the origins of someone. It's better to do it that way.
Right. Yeah, you know, the other thing, too, with this particular film is that they still manage to have good and evil without Jedi. Not that, I mean, they do that in Rogue One, but again, those lines are pretty clearly delineated, right? If you're pro-Empire, you're bad. If you're against the Empire, you're good. But this one's still, I mean, the areas are somewhat gray, but, you know, they still refer to him as the good guy. But then you look at all the anthology films, and, you know, good is always pretty well tied to the Jedi. And there's no reference to the Force in this film, which there couldn't have been, because that's one of his famous lines, right? I don't remember anything that told you about any Force that powers everything. You know, like, it actually sounds more like Jeff Bridges than Harrison Ford. But, you know, so there is that sort of good versus evil construct without any broad philosophy in the world, which is pretty interesting to me.
Yeah, well, it does seem to be also a direction I think some of the newer Star Wars films are going in. Like, because I noticed with Last Jedi, they traveled into that territory a little bit in suggesting, because there's a scene with Benicio del Toro in Last Jedi where they're on the ship that they've just stolen, and he's saying, well, who are the good guys and the bad guys? And they've just come from the gambling planet, and they're going through and they're showing holograms of all the items that whoever owned the ship was selling. And he's like, oh, yeah, you see they're selling these things to the bad guys. And, oh, no, but they're selling to the good guys, too. And then Benicio del Toro says, well, good guys, bad guys, like, he's really the first character, as far as I can think, in the Star Wars universe who sort of questions the dichotomy, the good and bad dichotomy. And I think that's something that it could also just be influenced by more contemporary storytelling, sure. that's now something too that's just had more of an influence. Even if you look in other mainstream Hollywood films, they seem to question more of the ideal, like the good versus evil idea.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, interesting about that particular quote in The Last Jedi, that's the first comment I think we've gotten from a Star Wars film which borders on anti-war in a world that's in a whole franchise that's based on a war.
Right.
Not even because of the name, just because that's what the whole world is based on, this thing. And that quote actually calls into question the nature of what they're doing in and of itself, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's wild. But, you know, I really just liked the movie. I admit. I just thought it was fun.
Yeah, it's fun, yeah. It's just really enjoyable.
You know what, guys? I could talk about this forever, but let's, because I just absolutely love this conversation, but let's do Screen It or Skip It. Solo, Screen It or Skip It.
Oh, I hope you know already the answer to that, Steve, and everyone who's listening, but yeah, screen it for sure. And again, you got to see a film like this on the big screen. I mean, I'm all for that. So grab a bag of popcorn and a chocolate bar and some more, get some milk, other sugar, some other way or something, but get to the theater, see the film. Yeah. It's a lot of fun. I'm with Nate. I'm with you. It's kind of a standalone piece.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Screen it all the way.
Okay.
I think screen it for sure.
Yeah.
That's definitely screen it. Yeah. It's good.
I have to agree. I do agree. I think it's fun. I really didn't think I would enjoy myself as much as I did. I agree with David that it should be seen on the big screen and not on your cell phone or, you know, from your, on your iPad as you're sitting on the bus.
Yeah, don't do that.
I say go for it. If you're invested in the world and if you like Star Wars, even if you hate Star Wars, don't see the film. But I think that it's a good film. It's enjoyable and it's well worth your money. So definitely, I agree with you both. Nate, David, thanks so much for being on the show. It's been absolutely great having you on. Nate, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Yeah, no, that was fun.
Yeah, and David, for you as well.
Thanks for having me on too. Really enjoy the conversation. I could do this all day.
Me too. I'm glad you could come on. Thanks so much, David. I appreciate it.
Oh, and hey, before I go, can I do a little shameless push? Is that okay?
Absolutely.
FaceToFaceLive.ca. There are other podcasts out there, Steve. I don't know if you knew that, but. And you can check us out. We got a lot of documentary filmmakers and got a couple of really interesting interviews coming up. I'm coming up on about my 400th interview, if you can believe that. And wow. It's facetofacelive.ca. Check us out there for more interviews. And I want to say thanks to Nate too for jumping on this call with us today. Nate and I are a quick little shout out if you don't mind, but Nate and I are working on a film together, and the current working title right now is Mango Rain. And I hope that one day we're going to be doing a podcast about it in the next couple of years.
Guys, again, thank you so much. And for all of you at home, a reminder that, yes, you can find Face to Face wherever podcasts are found. You can also find us wherever podcasts are found on Spotify, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, you name it. You can find us. We will be back when we talk about Incredibles 2. Not The Incredibles 2, because for some reason everybody seems to care that they've lost the definite article in their title. But we're excited about that, and you can check us out for some great interviews that we just posted as well. Michelle Weaver from the new series Love Is, and as well the Aaron and Jordan Kendall, the screenwriters for Adrift. But guys, again, thanks for being on. And for all of you at home, we started the conversation. This was Screenfish.